Hello, good morning, and you're very welcome to Countrywide. Between now and nine, a look back at a year on the land in 2025. Out the gap in Donegal, a good day in Tip, friendly stone walls in Sligo, partners in Meath, empty hill farms in Mayo, and taking a punt in Cork. Good morning, and you are very welcome to what is, with my apologies to Sinead Mooney, my playback of highlights from the last year on Countrywide. I meet loads of people on this programme who really love their jobs. It's not all rosy by any means, but pound for pound, there might be more job satisfaction in farming than in any other role. And the happiest man that I have met this year was sheep farmer Morris Leamy. We walked his land at the foot of the silver mines in Tip at the end of March for no reason whatsoever other than the sheer joy of it.
There's the ring fort now, Philip. There are all ancient burial grounds. You see the little ring there on top?
Can I take my life in my hands and stray into the middle of it, do you reckon?
Come on, there's no issue. They seem to come in here to lamb. I don't know why, but that's what they do. A lot of them have come in here to lamb.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know what's in it.
And would they come in here into the middle of the ring fort rather than take shelter in the trees around the edge?
A lot of them have come and just lambed here on top of it for some reason. I'm not saying it's a maternity ward, but a lot of them have come here. Yeah.
That's gas.
It is gas, yeah. I have a tree here with native Irish bees, and they're very important because apparently they're rare, and just this little alder tree. They're rare, and do you know, I said they're not aggressive, but they're coming a bit close to me now, Philip, so I'm going to move back. But they're rare, and to think that they're... Look at it, see the mountain coming there now, it's beautiful, isn't it? But to think that I have them on my farm, and I suppose why I might have them on my farm is because no pesticides, no herbicides, no chemical fertilizers. So that all helps, you know, that all helps.
Is that the reason behind getting out of dairying and into sheep?
No, the reason I got out of dairying was you can see the streams right beside my farmyard. Hmm. And when I got out of cows in 2004, I was actually milking 70 cows, five at a time. But it was just, when you're beside a stream and beside water courses, and like I have lots of dikes, drains, two rivers, it's just impossible to keep it, you know, especially in dairy, and you know, it just wasn't suiting that enterprise. Sheep, you know, less intensive, lots of hard work. It's more physical, you know what I mean? You'd be literally...
Is it really more physical?
Oh my God, it is, yeah. There'd be no need for the gym if you're into sheep, Philip.
This is a special little spot. What have you done here?
Oh, it's gorgeous. This is all oak. This year now, we can go in the second tinning and we'll take out a third of the oak. The ones that are crooked, you'll take out the ones that are bent over, you'll take out the ones that aren't growing that well or that could be forked, and you leave all the real nice ones. And you're just going to have a beautiful oak woodland. I never see the really benefit of it.
That was my question. Yeah. Some people would say to you, not in your lifetime will you ever get anything out of this. What do you get out of it?
I get more from it than I could ever get from it in a monetary value. You know, it's you come up here in the evening, come up here in the morning, it's just kind of a meditation, you know, and I'm not a tree hugger by any means, but I see the beauty in it, and I do get this amazing kind of energy from them, you know, and it's the noise, it's the, you know, you can hear the wind there now, and it's just blowing through the trees there now, and it's all that kind of thing, like, you just... Like, compare that into being in a town, in a city, being on concrete, being on this constant noise, being under pressure the whole time. Do you know? This is heaven.
This might sound like a stupid question on an absolutely glorious spring day as we walk through your field looking up at the silver mines. Why do you like farming?
I love being the decider of my own enterprise and what I can do and what I needn't do, and no one to tell me you're doing this wrong, you're doing that wrong.
Just to be a bit of a contrarian, are you really your own boss when you're a price taker? You can't control the price of an internationally traded commodity like lamb.
That's true. Well, I suppose I've one great advantage, Philip, over a lot of people, and that is I have zero interest in money.
Now, how do you achieve that?
Well, I don't know. I've no interest in it. And, you know, the way I consider life is you can only eat so much, like, you know, fancy cars and all the rest of it, fine clothes and fine dining. It never interests me. All I ever wanted to be was happy. And I found happiness here.
And what makes you most happy here?
Just today. Can you feel it? Can you see it?
I can, but I can also in my mind rewind the clock 3 months and say, God, how happy can it have been in the depths of the dark winter where you only have 7 hours of light in which to do things.
It's still beautiful, Philip. It's still beautiful. And every season has its beauty. And, you know, you'll see different things in the farm and at different stages throughout the year. And it is all lovely.
It's all a little slice of heaven, Morris. But it is also a working farm.
Yeah.
Do you make a living from it?
I do, yeah. You know, with any farm, all you can do is leave it in a better way and place than when they got it, you know. And nearly all farmers are doing that, you know, and want to do it, you know. They're not going out to destroy their landscape or anything like that. They're under a lot of pressure, Philip. They're under a lot of pressure. Bills to pay and all the rest of it, but life is very fickle and very short, and you know, it's for living, you know. Instead of putting their arms around everything and trying to grab everything, maybe just take a step back and see what's important in life.
It was beautiful that day in March, but it was a funny year for weather. Some farmers would say that 2025 was a pet of a year and everything went right. For others, the weather nearly broke them. Storm Eowyn swept all before it in January, including forestry plantations and horticulture polytunnels. At that time, there was a bit of a national debate about the number of emergency electricity generators we had in the country. But when I visited Bridget Murphy on her farm in Sligo, she reminded me that the other measure of your resilience is how good are your neighbours?
Do you ever reflect on how puny we are in the face of the kind of forces that can lift a stone wall and an ancient tree like that
and just
make matchsticks of them?
It's humbling. It's humbling, and it's actually, it takes the pressure off you, you know, when you look at the scale of what has to be done and how small and puny we are, as you mentioned, to tackle any of it. Sometimes it's quite nice knowing you're just a grain of sand. But when you put all of those grains of sand together, you get a beach, you get something. And that's also that sense that we were meant to come together. I mean, in the old days, farmers survived by helping each other out, by that concept of metal.
Dry stone wallers have always struck me as very philosophical people. Did this make you a philosopher?
You have no idea. It took me places and spaces. I was able to let go of some really deep resentment on this wall. Okay? I was able to forgive. I learned actually what the concept of forgiveness was. And when I get to the corner here, I'll show you, but I got to the corner. I couldn't see where I'd started. I couldn't see where I was going to finish. I picked up a rock. I dropped it. It smashed three of my fingernails, and I was sitting on the stones crying my eyes out. Now, picture this. It's November. I'm in a rain gear because it's lashing, but it's the time of the year I can get this done. And James Plunkett Leonard, who was an old neighbor, he drove up, and his window kind of creaked down on his car, and he said, "What's the matter?" And I said, "James, I can't carry on. This wall has broken me." So he said, "Look, I'll tell you what. I'll come up at 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon," because it was November, so it was getting dark early. And he said, "I'll have a look and inspect the work that you've done." So the next morning I woke up and I rolled over and my back was broken and my hands were sore and I was just so despondent. And I went, I can't face that wall. And then I thought, James is coming up at four. And if I've got nothing to show him, he'll have something to say to me. And he always had something to say to you. So I leapt out the bed and I did the next section. And every day for a month, he drove up.
On a practical level, since Storm Eowyn hit, what have you all been doing for each other?
All right. First of all, I arrived back and my wonderful neighbour had already had that tree cut. Yeah.
Now, that is very generous because nobody else has any need to go up your lane, do they?
Well, exactly. And funnily enough, the neighbour that I've spoken about with the stone walls, he actually cut a whole bunch that were posing a threat just before it.
Sometimes we're not great in this country about accepting people who we refer to as blow-ins. It must be kind of reassuring, though, that when an event like this happens, everybody pulls together and you're not a blow-in any longer. You're a neighbour.
You know, I think I'll always be a blow-in. I think I came here as a blow-in. My great-uncle Frank was born on this mountain. He went and worked in London. He retired back here and he was a blow-in for that. I mean, on one level, yes, I think I'll always be a blow-in. But in terms of the acceptance, you know, the old fella James that I was telling you about, he watched me for a while and then the one day he stopped and he said, "Your Uncle Tommy would be happy the way you're treating his sheep." And I suddenly realised I got one of the biggest compliments that was going.
And that was the moment of acceptance into this little community, do you think?
Well, certainly then he would have seen me as a neighbour farmer rather than just some very strange woman who pitched up and is living in a caravan on the side of a mountain. Mm. But no more than that, as I say, I mean, the neighbour here, Brian, he would help me out a lot. He's got tractors and quads and the ability to help me with a lot of that stuff. And by the same token, I've been able to help him out with extra grazing for his animals. And I do my own hay and silage. So if I had extra bales, he can pick them up. So we help each other out that way as well. But you are only as good as your neighbours, to tell the truth.
Bridget Murphy in Sligo. For my money, one of the best ways that we capture the mood of a moment on Countrywide is our network of letter writers, one of the most penetrating and simultaneously lyrical of whom is Keith Brennan on Hawthorne Hill Farm in Roscommon. His description of his community's reaction to the storm was pitch perfect.
"It's the night before Eowyn and I'm in Ballinamore, a meeting to discuss the fallout from Storm Dara. Stories are pouring into the room. People remembering the trees, blocked roads, days and for some the week of no water, no internet, no light, no heat. Some are 6 weeks later with no water still. The room is thronged. The storm and the anger at what has been has drawn many tonight. We talk, share and plan. Place our stories, hope and trust in one another, in community. There is a sense of being failed by organisations, companies and regulations that many feel protect profit over people. Storm Eowyn comes. I watch through the bedroom window on my farm as the trees windscreen wipe across the dawning sky. The rending crack of broken or uprooted trees. The whole entire woods behind my house scrubbed clean from the world. Pure sky where a forest last night had been. I go to clear the trees from the road. My son comes with me. We work. Our breath braided steam in the frozen air, snow crunching underfoot, the rattle and drum of just cut rounds of wood on the steel bed of the trailer, the tick-tick-tack of the hazard lights, the song of a thrush, and the roar of a distant saw at the same work as us. The next evening I'm amazed when my power returns. Neighbours, though, are not so lucky. We drop boxes of dried firewood to one. For another we cook an oven roast dinner. She curls around our radiator like a settling cat. We heave gallons of water into the boot of her car before she drives back into the cold and dark of home. Days stretch into a week. The houses on the hill still dark, power lines coiled in gardens and on roads. They'll be dark and cold until the 5th. A week after Eowyn, I meet a neighbour. She stretches a hand through her car window. Feel my hands. She is in tears from the week-long cold. She drives off quickly, does not want me to see, the brokenness catching in her throat. The second storm has brought with it something new. Disbelief. How have we been left to fend so much for ourselves and one another? Where are the answers? Where is the help? Carnage and kindness happen together, and, though kindness springs from that disaster, it outlasts it. But I worry, too, that the anger will have a longer life than both.
He wasn't wrong about that, was he? Part of the new normal is how the weather will whiplash from one extreme to another. Keith wrote that in February, just 5 weeks later. I found myself in the Barnsmore Gap in Donegal searching with Niall Bryson for the other half of his flock of sheep that had gone missing in a devastating wildfire. Niall, this is really sobering. Yeah. Everything in like 270 degrees around you here is burnt off.
This wasn't burning when I came up here.
Okay, but then there's only a rock face and the tiny little gap to the road behind you.
Yeah.
You could very easily have gotten trapped in here and overcome by smoke.
Well, at the time, I was just trying to get the sheep that I could find down the hill. And as I say, I suppose you don't be thinking. I didn't know that it would stop here, and thankfully it did.
When you get right down to it, you see what's going on. That old millennia grass. Yeah,
that's right.
That's so dry now, it's like crepe paper.
That's right, that's right. And you know, it's amazing, put your hand there for a couple of seconds, and it's actually wet underneath. It's wet, the ground is wet, but it still ignites so well, and on the top. Along the top.
Because the heather is really brittle as well, isn't it? It just snaps in your hand.
That is like wind bushes. When it ignites, it really takes off, The heather is pure fuel. What's along the top here? What's dry? It's a tinderbox. It only takes a week for that to dry up when you get a dry spell to be like that.
Is there ever any controlled burning done here?
We don't. We're not allowed to burn the mountain.
For wildlife reasons.
For wildlife, absolutely, yeah. It's not within the farmer's interest to burn. Absolutely not. No, it's not. No, we wouldn't. We have too much to lose if we start burning.
I'm surprised to hear you say that, though, because controlled burning would presumably minimise the chances of this happening again.
Well, it's such a vast area, Philip, and there is a lot of wildlife out here as well, and we just are doing what we've been told not to burn. Mm-hmm. And because we have too much to lose, farmers have too much to lose, we wouldn't think about burning. I suppose this time I can just be thankful that I suppose fire services were able to control it, and keep it under wraps and not let it spread. And the weather, of course, was a major factor. It wasn't windy,
but it took helicopters with buckets.
It did, and it was great that we had all that to put it out, because otherwise it would have just kept spreading and spreading.
We better find some sheep.
Yeah.
Where do you think they'll be?
I think they're going to be down the bottom of this hill here. But yeah, there's a fantastic view from up here as well. You can see back there, old Donegal Bay.
It is amazing. All the way down to Benbulbin.
That's right. You can see Neffing when it's a really clear day.
That's in flames as well. I wonder, can you see the smoke? Bit too misty today.
Probably it's just the hazy smoke is covering the view.
How many sheep are we looking for?
Well, I'd say about the guts 15 or 20.
Oh, okay.
But I think I have an idea that they're further round and down.
On the night of the fire, Niall, how many neighbours did you get out to help you?
Cal McNulty, neighbour of mine, rang me asking, need a hand? I said, yeah. He came out with his dog, squad. Then I had the three Kyle brothers as well, Paul, Damien and Barry. And then Mick Kilcoyne, the sergeant, was out as well. And of course, along with my father as well. But he was in his 80s.
I assume that while help is all very well-meaning, it's not much use unless they have a working dog with them.
Well, I didn't have the working dog with me in the beginning, because usually I don't take a dog with me when they're heavy and long.
Right.
But on this occasion, I wish I had taken my dog with me, because I could have forced him down the mountain faster.
Success.
Yeah.
Well done.
You can't see them, Philip. They'd be below you and above you. Very hard to see them until you're on top of them.
Now, they're very heavily pregnant.
They're ready to lamb any day now.
It's a delicate job bringing them down.
Yeah, you don't want to be too sore on them. I say, I'd rather not bring the dog with me, but as I say, I keep her at my side. She doesn't go out far.
Yeah, but when you're covering these kind of distances, you'd need the dog.
Yeah, you do, you know, especially when there's hills. Come here, Lily. The sheep can be a little bit skittish, you know, when they're pregnant.
What wildlife do you see here?
Birds, predominantly. Foxes. Lizards. It could be the badger as well. So there does be a lot going on up here.
Golden eagle?
Golden eagle as well, yeah.
That's a good sign, isn't it? I mean, if you have an apex predator, is it a breeding pair or just the one?
It's a breeding pair, yeah. Yeah, not breeding not too far away from here.
Well, then there's plenty in the food chain beneath them if they've established themselves here, isn't
Absolutely,
there?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, there's lots to eat.
So it kind of suggests that you're getting the balance between overgrazing and undergrazing about right.
I think so, yeah. I think we do quite a good job here between overgrazing and undergrazing. It's the mountain's well managed. There's enough between sheep and cattle to keep it grazed, yeah.
And what do you say to those people who say, oh, there shouldn't be any grazing on the uplands at all? The sheep have completely denuded the landscape.
No, I think there does have to be grazing on the uplands. It's very important. You know, there's always been grazing on the uplands. If there wasn't, you know, things would grow completely wild, as would the fields if there was no stock on the fields.
And then you have fires where nothing survives.
Absolutely. Like, absolutely. I mean, there's a reason why they do it in Spain. They have flocks of sheep now on the perimeters of cities, grazing the vegetation. It's to stop fires.
I can tell you, I slept that night. Nothing to do with counting sheep, just trying to keep up with Niall. More after the break.
Email countrywide@rte.ie.
Good morning. If you're just joining us, we're looking back on the last 12 months of Countrywide. There was lots happening throughout the farming year. Plummeting milk prices, soaring beef prices, skyrocketing TB cases, the will they, won't they drama of renewing the nitrates derogation. But there is a problem on farms that is probably bigger than all of the above. Getting the next generation of farming. Those who have access to land mostly don't want to, and those who do want to can't access land. In January, I met two men, previously strangers, one older, one younger, who had formed a partnership to address precisely this problem.
From a young age, I always had to grow for it. Dad's side of the family were beef farming, and mum's side of the family are dairy farming. And from as young as I can remember, I was always around both farms, particularly mum's. Family farm.
And those people who end up not having a farm typically go into some end of agribusiness. That wasn't going to be enough for you. You had to be milking cows, did you?
Yeah, I got a job actually locally with Dairy Co-op, and I actually worked there for 6 years. But throughout that time, I was always looking for my own opportunity. It was always in the back of my mind. I was never going to be happy unless I gave a go.
Farm Mobility Services put Tony and Chris in touch. They walked the land together and then effectively interviewed one another to see if their ideas of what way the farm should be developed matched each other's.
I suppose when Paddy called me from the Land Mobility to say that there was an opportunity here, it was just a case of coming up, putting your best foot forward, and from then on it was about being as realistic as possible about what we could achieve with the farm, because you could have come in here and said to Tony, geez, we'll milk 500 cows and we'll make a millions clear profit and everything will be fantastic. But I kind of wanted to be as realistic as possible about what we could achieve.
And was that what it was about, Tony, putting your plan and Chris's plan on the table beside each other and seeing, you know, how many points did they match?
It was actually a lot simpler than that, Philip, because my plan and Chris's plan were the exact same. He literally were the exact same.
So you were well suited to each other from the outset. Yeah. True love.
Yeah. Kind of what a respected partner would think about that.
Exactly. Exactly. Cut that one out.
Way a day or two next week, so my meet up next week or whatever.
Yeah,
I'm okay for this weekend, by the way. Again,
I think I've more or less what do you call him from Alan Doran has the prof on her finish, so I'll forward.
What they now have is a 10-year deal. Both draw an income from an expanded herd. Tony works off farm but keeps his hand in without breaking his back, and Chris gets the land to develop a herd which will be his at the end of the deal.
My family is now getting an income out of it. Tony's family is still getting an income out of it. And Dylan, the guy that I've employed, he's getting an income out of it. So there's three families still earning out of the one farm.
What do people say to you? You're giving somebody else the best farming years of your life, and what are you going to have to show for it?
Yeah, there's certainly a resistance from maybe young guys to come in and invest a huge amount of money and time in a business they may not eventually own. And likewise, I think from the landowner's perspective, there's still quite a resistance to kind of step away from the coal face, to step away from the farm. Like, there's, you know, they'd be quite happier going from milking 100 cows down to milking 20 or 30 cows and still tipping away themselves rather than bringing a guy in to develop and push on. Like, they don't want to release the reins. Yeah.
Tony was stretched thin between the farm and the job. He didn't have the time to also stay up to date with changes in farming. But with a progressive young farmer on board came the peace of mind that the land was being managed more sustainably than if he was on his own.
Over time, whether we like it or not, your skills get redundant. I wasn't as up to date as I could be because I couldn't attend open days and I couldn't get involved in discussion groups because it was working. To a certain extent, you lose the interest or you're not quite as good as you should be. I'd be the first one to admit it. And Chris brings that youth to the area. He loads of time to get involved. Like, he's here full time. He's far more time. I was kind of trying to do both. And like, things, I won't say to say things suffer. We tipped along nicely here for years and everything went
good.
But
they could have been better.
They could have been better, definitely, definitely.
Chris and Tony were making their best go of it, but they are in a minority. In September, we looked at the reason for record high beef prices. In Mayo, it was obvious that the failure to pass the farm on to the next generation had contributed in a major way to a shortage of supply of cattle. That break in the link on the chain of grandfather to father to son weighed heavily on John Moran as he showed me around his farm overlooking Clew Bay, now empty of any cattle. Now that's a view.
That is a view.
That is a view.
There's supposed to be 365 islands in Clew Bay, one for every day of the year. Now some of them isn't grazable, but...
You've grazed some of these islands.
I own one of them islands.
Yeah?
Yeah.
In the hills overlooking Clew Bay, John Moran should have been preparing his weanlings for this week's mart. But a tough conversation with his son about farm finances 3 years ago means that he got out of sucklers altogether.
I had a young lad going farming, or thinking about going farming, and his wife. Well, it was his wife mainly. And... there was a sit down at the kitchen table and there was figures done on the cattle and they just didn't add up. Different game today maybe with the price of cattle this year, but they didn't add up back then.
And add up to what? Add up to two incomes or add up to an income for them? Well, or would they be spending most of their time off the farm?
They'd be spending a lot of their time off the farm, yes. They have both have jobs and he probably won't give up his job, she probably will. We'll do a bit more farming than he'll do. And she's mad into it. She likes it. So she'll farm it. But she won't farm it the way I farmed it. She won't farm it with a lump of cattle. Doing what I done. Spending that actual time going in the hill here with cattle and turning them and looking at them and minding them. And
that was 3 years ago. So I'd imagine the dust has settled on it by now. But it strikes me like it was a tricky conversation.
Well, that's putting it very mildly. It was, and I suppose it was tricky on my behalf because I didn't want to hear it. And I didn't want to get out of cows. I liked my old cows. They were grand.
You spent your whole life doing it.
That's it, you see. We followed them when we were 5 and 6. And we stayed following them. And I stayed following them until I was 60. So, look, they were lovely. They were grand. But times has to move on. You have to respect the younger ones. The younger ones isn't going to do it. There wasn't enough money out of it. The young lad sat down at the table here. He says, look, he says, as simple as this. To make this pay, Dad, you'd want a weanling every week to sell.
And there wasn't going to be 52 animals to be sold.
There was. I had only 10.
Yeah.
And that's if them all kept in calf.
So the lesser of two evils was dispensing with the way you farmed your entire life so that the farm could stay in the family.
Yes, that would be plain and simply put. The farm can stay now in the family and hopefully will, because with any bit of luck, I'll be retired in 3 years' time and there'll be nobody else to take it over.
But tomorrow, busy mart in Ball, and you're not going to be there.
No.
How does that feel?
It feels fine when you're at home, but I don't think I go to Belmart. What's the point of going to Belmart?
So, I don't know, what are we looking at here? Somewhere between 15 and 20 farms, if we do the whole panorama view. How many of those would still be in cattle?
6.
Okay. If I was to ask you the same question 20 years ago, what would the answer have been?
A lot of them.
Everybody?
Yes.
Succession. Countless family dramas playing out in private behind closed front doors. In August, a national tragedy, though, played out very publicly. The biggest fish kill in Irish history occurred on the Blackwater in Munster. Whoever was to blame can't now be found. One of the biggest reactions we have ever had to a story was when we brought the heads of several government agencies working on the river into studio. They told us one after the other how it wasn't in the remit of their agency to find who was responsible. In the same programme, we also heard from those living on the Blackwater about how what is happening to the river actually hurt them.
I love looking at reflections on the river of the foliage, the trees and stuff like that. I love reflections, but obviously, there's a lot of wildlife out there as well. Otters, kingfishers, herons. I love herons as well, you know.
Dennis Murray runs boat tours of the Blackwater River, mostly between Lismore and Cappoquin. How long are you on the river?
50, 51 years.
In a half a century on the same river. Does it ever get monotonous?
No. If you went out twice a day, the river was different every time. You never know what you're kind of going to see or, like, you know, particularly with the tide rising and falling. I'm a kind of Cappoquin person and we deal a lot of the time with the tide. I'd always aim, if I was downriver, to go with the tide. And I have the best part of the river. I can go places in around the islands. I call it the Everglades. When I have the tide, if I don't have the tide, I can't get in there, you know.
It's a very different way of looking at a day then, isn't it? Not by what the clock says or when the sun is rising or setting, but by the ebbing and the flowing of the tide.
Well, that's the way it was, you know what I mean? If you go back 100 years ago, there'd have been boats coming up from Beall, but like it might take them 3 or 4 days to get up because they're waiting for the tide or they're waiting for the wind. There's something, just the feel of the paddle going into the water and just paddling at your own pace and you can stop or start or whenever you like, you know.
Would it sadden you if the river was to become just a channel for dirty water rather than a living, breathing thing?
Of course. like the it's been there for centuries, and it's very important to keep it there. Like you can go out there to the just beyond Capoquin there, and there like you could see 10 or 15 people out there just at the rock, and they're having a chat and having a look at the water. It's very popular for people to come and just sit there, you know, and watch the tide go in or out.
You have planted quite a lot of trees here. These are...
Yeah, these are oak.
What, 20, 25 years ago did you do that?
Yes, about that. And
coming along nicely.
Yeah. No, that bit has gone...
A few miles downstream from Capoquin, Kristen Jemison is the ninth generation direct descendant of the whiskey distiller John Jemison. She still lives on the banks of the river that she grew up beside.
It's always been there. It's part of me. And my mother brought over a clinker-built rowing boat from Norway. She used to go out with my father of an evening. Can you imagine? And they'd go up on high with a tide and wait for half an hour and have their cup of coffee up by Capoquin. And then drift down with a long line behind them and catch sea trout.
I think that's about one of the most romantic things that I have ever heard. So they would row upstream.
Yes.
Have their little drink.
Yes.
Throw a fishing line at the back of the boat and
then
drift home.
And drift down with the tide.
Bringing dinner with them.
That's right. That's right. And I'm afraid... that's an experience that we will never see again. There are no trout, and or very, very, very few. And the salmon numbers have also deteriorated. You know, it's so sad, because it's not there now.
What used and you see?
Kingfishers. Can you imagine? Those blue flashes. And then... all the winter waders, and one of the terrible things that has happened, and I mean it's really quite a disgrace, is that our plovers have gone. There are no plovers, golden plovers left, and the sound of them in the morning is just wonderful.
What does that do to you, that loss?
It's an emptiness, isn't it, when you think that they are no longer here, and I think...
And that happened during your lifetime as well?
Not in my lifetime, in half my lifetime. And, I mean, that's due to so many different causes. Drainage, forestry, and intensive farming, without a doubt.
Do you have a sense, then, of a river that's in distress?
Yes, I'll have to say that. Yes... I don't think of it like that because I love it so much. But very sadly, I have to say that.
Just they started with a hush years ago, didn't you, Jim?
Yeah.
And their showers were to jump into the
river.
Just
a bit of a... afterwards. They called it a crush. Mm-hmm. A wooden hush.
A half an hour upstream by car in Fermoy, 90-year-old Jim Lycett goes for a walk on the banks of the Blackwater every day. Today, his wife Anne has joined him.
Go on, Anne, you take a seat there as well. Can I sit in between the two of you?
You can, of course.
Yeah. Sorry, what's your name again?
Philip.
Is Boucher Hayes your second name?
It is.
Yeah. New names can be hard to keep a hold of. But the river is the way that Jim connects to all his old memories.
Yeah, I love this place. It means a lot. All the people I knew walked here, rowed in the river, swam, walked.
His dad, his father rowed here and all, you know.
Yeah.
Your father rowed here. And
your dad rowed here.
If you answer yes to this question, you might get in a bit of trouble, but I'll defend you in court if it comes to it. When you were a boy... did you ever take a pearl out of one of the pearl mussels in the river?
I probably did. I did.
You're owning up to that.
That's a long time ago.
My friend did, Your Honour. They were highly prized, those pearls, weren't they?
It's a long time ago. I have a very vague memory of it. But I remember the shell being just like we'd see a mussel, you know, a mussel that you'd find on the beach or by the riverbank. And the petal didn't, they don't look anything in the raw state like that, you know. I think they need a bit of culture or something maybe.
There were people came over from Scotland every summer and they'd go diving for the summer. And one year they came and they found, the rumour was that they did find a big mussel and somebody gave them good money and they didn't come back anymore okay. after that. Isn't that true?
But Camille, the pearl that he's saying that he found, mm-hmm. did he present this to you in a ring or in a necklace by any chance?
Maybe another lady, it's before my time.
Are you going to plead the fifth on that one?
I'll think about it.
What's your favourite time of day on the river, Jim?
Well, any time is lovely. Early morning is lovely, but the evening here is very special. Just the place it is, it means so much with all we've experienced here.
When you see the river getting polluted and you see insects and animals like that getting affected, how does it make you feel, Jim?
Oh, make me feel very sick. Sick. It has been polluted and we have seen fish kills, big fish kills, hurt you.
It hurts you.
You feel the river is almost a part of you, you know, or you're a part of it. Yeah, we just love the river.
It's not just nature that gets hurt when we injure it. We're hurting ourselves too. Let me leave you, though, with a brighter thought. The shortest day of the year was 6 days ago. We are over the astronomical hump, so to speak. Last April, I gathered up all of the sounds of spring that I had recorded around the country and I put them into one place. We have never had so many requests to play something again. So, here it is. We're back next week. Thanks for listening this morning. A very happy new year to you and to all of yours.
That programme was produced by Eileen Herron, and the music there was Max Richter's recomposition of Spring from Vivaldi's Four Seasons, performed by the Concerthaus Camera Orchestra, Berlin.